afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Monday, June 1st, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Monday, Melody.
Happy Monday to you, too. And we had a nice happy Monday in gold today. Couldn't hold the true great gain of the day, but still in the New York spot price market. Gold is up $960 at $1,739. Silver is up 46 cents at $18.40. Platinum was up 18 at $850, and palladium was up $29 at $2,014. The USDX today was weaker earlier. It still is down 0.51 at 97.81. Crude oil was up 7 cents at 35.56. And the paper markets right now up 91 points on the Dow, 25,475. The NASDAQ is up 62 points, 9,552. The S&P is up 11 at 3,055. 10-year yield, 0.66%. European, Asian markets were all, well, Germany was down, you know, 1.65%. Everything else was green. Even Hong Kong was up almost 3.5%. So, you know, a good day for them. And yeah, I mean, I guess it goes and points to the algorithms, Dave, because I don't know what it takes to make markets move. Just doesn't seem that anything does. Kind of seems like, the world is literally blowing up. And that good old Dow just keeps plugging along. But I have an article here, Dave, we can talk about a little bit later on, but it's out of the Wall Street Journal about individual investors who are getting burned by the collapse of complex securities. And, they poured all their savings that they had into these leveraged accounts, you know, thinking that they're never, ever going to have a big day, thinking that they're smarter than the markets, and they're just weeks away from bankruptcy. So, you know, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. But first, let's go ahead and some of the manufacturing, some good news. It seems to be easing off the 11-year low from May. This is the strongest sign yet that maybe the worst of the downturn is behind as we begin to see businesses reopen. I don't know if it was behind, but I mean, we certainly, maybe that was the bottom. The Institute for Supply Management said its index of national factory activity rose to a 43.1 last month from 41.5 in April. And that April number was the lowest level since the April of 2009. Now, again, to recap, a reading below 50 indicates contraction in manufacturing. And again, to recap, the 11% of our economy is manufacturing, 11%. The first increase in the ISM index since January mirrored negligible improvements in regional manufacturing surveys in May. And of course, we all know there's millions of jobs that have been lost, Dave.
We also know that the economy contracted at a 4.8% annualized rate last quarter, worst performance since the Great Recession. GDP is expected to decline at a rate as sharp as 42% in the quarter that ends at the end of this month. And that would be the biggest contraction in GDP since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Now, the ISM's forward-looking new order subindex increased to a reading of 31.8 in May from 27.1 in April. And that was, again, the lowest since December 2008. The survey's measure of order backlogs at factories rose to 38.2 after plummeting in April to 37.8. There was also a slight improvement in the ISM's measure of factory employment, which advanced to a reading of 32.1 after plunging to 27.5 in April. That happened to be the lowest since February of 1949. Melody.
1949?
How about it?
Wow. Well, you know, we're going to be talking about the paper markets later on, and, you know, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of positive for these markets. You know, there's been a big rotation into unloved stocks like banks and small caps, airlines, and that all kind of took a break last Friday, but it could be a theme that dominates trading again in the weeks ahead. Paper investors are assessing the progress of economic reopenings. I think they're going to be hindered by what we're seeing and experiencing around the country when you have 140 cities that's can't control the people and the rioting. So it's I would think that would hinder some of this economic progress, you know, for the reopenings that so many had hoped for would make a difference. We've seen the stock market is mostly discounting unprecedented weakness in the economic data, but the May unemployment report is still be a major interest this coming Friday. That's right, that'll be this Friday. Economists expect it to show another shocking loss of jobs, this time roughly 8.5 million after the 20.5 million that was lost in April. The headline unemployment rate is expected to jump to a staggering 19.8% from the 14.7%. We, like John Williams at shadowstats.com, believe the real unemployment rate is already over 35%, and that's including the discouraged workers and those who have just, you know, stopped looking. But you still have the government and you still have mainstream media that continue to rely on grossly misleading data and reporting the numbers. And Dave, I'm sure that's not the only area that we get grossly misleading data, but...
Yeah, there's, again, some just wild contradictions in the inflation numbers mm-hmm. as well.
Good
we
point.
Talked about in part last week, but, you know, increasingly freight relations between the U.S. and China are rearing its ugly head at the end of last week, and analysts expect that stress to continue to be a concern for especially the paper markets. Last Friday, President Trump said the U.S. would end its preferential trade relationship with Hong Kong, and he announced the U.S. exit from the World Health Organization, which he said has failed with China to protect the world from the spread of the virus. More on China in a few minutes. Now, analysts say that continuing protests and riots across American cities will also turn negative for investor sentiment. Gold, on the other hand, has reacted positively to all the domestic and international turmoil and the related economic uncertainty by continuing its upward movement since the middle of last week. Of course, as Melody mentioned, it continues its climb today. Now, Art Hogan, who's chief market strategist at National Security, said, "At the levels we're at, I wouldn't be surprised to see the market take a pause and pull back." All sorts of articles out there over the weekend and today by analysts and other observers fearing significant falls in the Dow Jones and S&P over the coming months. Julian Emanuel, who heads equity and derivative strategy at BTIG, said social media and tech firms face dual headwinds, and that could hold back the overall market as well. Of course, we know now that the president issued an executive order last Thursday aimed at limiting legal protections of social media companies that after Twitter fact-checked a few of his tweets.
Can executive orders do that?
It's a dubious proposition. A number of at least mainstream legal analysts suggest that he does not have that kind of authority. But because some of the liability issues and how social media companies have been defined in federal law, They say because of that, any changes in that relationship require a change in the legislation, similar to some of the immigration issues that have been bandied back and forth over the past several years.
Who would have given the social media companies the legal protections? Does that come from Congress or?
Is that where it would come from? There was, I forget the name of the law now, but yeah, that's correct. It's how they've been defined in the federal legislation provides them that they're not considered publishing companies. So it's always talk about that on Wednesday. Put together some talking points to clarify that for listeners.
Well, you know, you mentioned that there's been a lot of articles about, you know, corrections coming our way. And again, there was the chief financial officers of a lot of these major corporations around the globe see that the Dow Jones Industrial Average retesting the 19,000 level. We think it's going to go along. Yeah, it's going to retest it, and then it's going to plow right through it. But they also see, you know, there's a few of them that see it hitting another record high. I don't know before or after, but this is according to the second quarter 2020 CNBC Global CFO Council survey. Only 22% of the global CFOs expect the Dow to reach a new record high without first experiencing another major decline, while 51% of CFOs are betting that the Dow is headed back below 19,000. The bleakest outlook comes from the CFOs in Europe, the Middle East, and the African region, where only 10% of the CFOs believe that the Dow is headed for another record. That's versus 70% of EMEA chief financial officers who see another big drop. Let's see. Nearly half expect the Dow to fall back below 19,000, but one-third think, well, we had already mentioned that, Dave.
Yeah, 20% of CFOs in that EMEA region in North America said they weren't sure about the next major move in U.S. stocks. CFOs from Asia were almost twice as likely to express uncertainty, with 37% preferring not to make a call on the Dow, though the rest of the Asia-based CFOs were more negative, with 44% expecting a Dow to decline back to the March low. Of course, two-thirds of U.S.-based CFOs support another round of federal stimulus. The North American CFOs, interestingly, do not endorse the Federal Reserve considering negative interest rates. 85%, in fact, of them oppose that concept. And let's see. Say the overall economic outlook from CFOs has worsened in recent months. They found CFOs around the world negative on the GDP outlook in every global region and describing conditions in the U.S. in the worst terms in the history of the survey. So, still not that sure how telling their opinions are, but certainly interesting to see that there's perhaps more of a slightly realistic tinge among the CFOs, particularly when compared to the CEOs, who generally are more optimistic, even in the face of of a lot of bleakness, darkness, whatever you want to call it.
When did they do this survey?
That's a good question. I don't know that I remember that.
But most likely it was before we've had all the situations around the country.
Before the George Floyd protests.
Right.
Yes. I just don't know if it was a week or so ago or, earlier in April.
Well, you know, again, I mean, it's like, you know, when you're in a decline, it's like all of these things happen all at once. And I think that's what we're experiencing. Everything is like, it's just like one after another. And on Friday, when President Trump announced new measures aimed at punishing China for both its role in the COVID-19 pandemic and the new phase in the Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong, he left one big potential action out. The decision not to withdraw from a partial trade agreement he signed with China in January did cheer investors, prompted a turnaround in the markets, and drew a collective sigh of relief also from the American farmers. And that reaction may have been a little premature, as new reports today are out there that Chinese officials have ordered a pause in imports of some U.S. soybeans as tensions rise. But the decision not to walk away served as a reminder for something else. Even if the deal survives, Trump's China trade strategy is running out of steam, well short of its promised destination. And as a reminder, that big idea that Trump brought into the White House was that he would be better than any of his predecessors at holding China to account, the rebalancing of the economic relationship. I mean, that was a difficult challenge. And at least it was attempted.
Indeed. I mean, the deal itself was modest. I mean,
exactly.
The U.S. offered some relief on tariffs. In return, China committed to revamp its intellectual property protections and to buy $200 billion in additional U.S. exports over the next 2 years. That's a target proving to be as elusive as experts said it would. The promise was in the branding of January's Phase 1 agreement. By labeling it the first in a series, the U.S. held out the promise of bigger and better things to come. After the initial phase, another one would tackle the key issues in the relationships that I just mentioned. That includes things like the industrial subsidies that have helped give an unfair leg up to many of the Chinese companies that have grown into fierce global competitors. More recently, presumably it would also include plenty of Chinese commitments to buy more American products, again, especially agriculture, which brings us to the first two ways Friday's action adds to the case for the U.S.'s trade strategy losing steam. I mean, never mind the initial phase, what's dying far more quickly is the idea that there can be any future ones.
But what we do have for sure is a break. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit your website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you visit our website and sign up for a weekly newsletter, and you can listen to these programs live and archived. And Dave, I just have to say this one more time. You know, silver eagles are beginning to float around. And I went online to see what people are charging. For a tube of 20, it was over $31. That was, what, a 33% markup? 36% something? It's like, are you kidding me? If you buy 1500 plus, then you're only paying 25, 26% commission. And I know people are doing it all day long. And it's like, are you nuts? And I hear the argument. Well, I just want to get rid of my fiat dollars, and you know, because you know I might not have tomorrow till tomorrow. I mean, come on. If you stop buying the silver eagles at the high price, the premiums will drop, just like we're seeing the premiums drop on gold eagles. But you fuel it. And the big sellers of silver eagles out there, the wholesalers, they're not giving them to dealers who will only charge, instead of charging $31, they charge a buck and a half over wholesale, because they know that's going to drop the price. Nobody wants to compete with that. So, ladies and gentlemen, come on. Don't go out there and buy something just because you think that you won't have till until tomorrow. If we don't have tomorrow, then it doesn't really matter. I can't imagine anybody would want to pay 33%+ for silver. It's just amazing. Anyway, I had to get that off my chest. And it's okay to buy things other than gold eagles and silver eagles, contrary to what you've been hearing. Oh, my. Anyway, so there are premiums are beginning to drop in some of the other silver products. But it's not the silver eagles, because they got you all wound up when just buying silver eagles. So, I just don't get it. I don't get it, Dave. You know? I just don't get it. But anyway, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Silver eagles will, you know, if the premiums come down, they're good buys. There are some honest dealers out there. I'm one of them. I'm not going to charge you 33, 36%. There's even some good wholesalers out there, because they don't want to charge me the high premium that they're being charged. Are we going to go broke? No. It's just not worth it. You know, it should mean something in today's world, but I guess it doesn't, Dave. You know, you try to, you know, I guess it really doesn't matter anymore, Dave. You know, you try to do something to make sure people get a good price, good product, they get the truth, and all that crap doesn't matter anymore. Because they get caught up in all the sensationalism that they hear online, that the world is coming to an end tomorrow, and it might, so therefore your 33-36% commissions on your Silver Eagle ain't going to matter anyway. Good grief. I, for one, believe what we will wake up one day to a whole different world. Maybe we've already have. We just haven't acknowledged it yet. No, we still got a long way to go. But so come on, use some common sense. And I don't mean to get you all upset if, you know, you're out there buying that high premium Silver Eagles. But if you stop buying, the premiums will come down. And it's always the smaller investor. It's the smaller investor who pays the higher price. The big investor buys something else, because he's not going to charge that much commission. So it's the little guy. There are other things to buy. 800-375-4188. Now, remember LIBOR? And I'm glad you brought this, Dave, because in a year, it's going to change, I believe. Maybe even at the later this year, the London Interbank Offered Rate. We've discussed the LIBOR, what it is and what's wrong with it, several times, many times, over the past couple of years. It's the key benchmark that's used by large international banks to charge each other for short-term loans. It affects everything. Mortgages, car loans. I mean, it's everywhere. It's the dominant interest rate off of which $350 trillion worth of adjustable rate mortgages and other financial assets are priced. $350 trillion. Its flaws had been known for over two decades. They manipulated them. Everybody knew about it. And yet it has persisted due to inertia and network effects, the same things that keep social networks so dominant. LIBOR is finally set to be retired over the next year or so, but it's an extraordinary, difficult task to get rid of it and transition it to a new benchmark, Dave.
It's true. And every week, the host of the podcast called Odd Lots, Joe Weisenthal and Tracy Alloway, take us on a walk through hot topics in the markets, finance, and economics. Well, all five of their podcasts this week are about LIBOR. On the first episode in their series today, Weisenthal and Alloway speak with Richard Robb, who the students on the listeners' side know as a former interest rate trader who was one of the first to warn about potential manipulation of LIBOR. Rob, who's now CEO of the hedge fund Christofferson Robin Company, he also teaches at Columbia University in New York, warned of problems in the interest rate as early as the mid-1990s. Wow. He also had a front row seat to witness the benchmark's downfall after the 2008 financial crisis. And he talks on the podcast about just what went wrong. And there was a lot that did. We bring this to your attention because we plan to recap the podcast during one or more financial survival programs next week. And because if you like to listen to podcasts, you can go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and search for Odd Lots, two words, O-D-D-L-O-T-S, which is the name of the program. So hopefully there's... sounds like it's going to be an insightful and informative series this week. Give us an opportunity to get caught up on just where we are, particularly with replacements in both the U.S. and in the U.K. and Europe. These are replacements for LIBOR.
You know, it is interesting. I mean, I don't know how... I think it has to happen... I don't know if it does or not, but, you know, when we look at the repo markets overnight, I mean, there has to be. I mean, that's only less than a year away. I thought they were going to start changing it over at the end of this year into next year, or is it the end of next year?
No, it was supposed to be this year.
This year, yeah. And how is that going? Do they talk about how it's going to affect the financial markets?
I haven't listened to it yet.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
I suspect it will.
I'm looking forward to it. I can't imagine it's going to be positive. I mean, you're talking about 350.
Once again, there's the realist in you.
I mean, $350 trillion.
Yeah, that's an incredible amount of upheaval. And I suspect that's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, reasons it's taking so long. I think there's probably just a lot of fear about the uncertainty by all the parties to these complicated and even not so complicated transactions that are just out there, and how they could affect, how they could upset the value, the new market values of these products. So it will indeed be interesting to see where. Hopefully, they have a good array of guests that'll give us a decent perspective on the matter.
Well, we're going to go ahead and change topics a little bit. We're going to lots of interesting topics, things that there's a lot of news out there going on, ladies and gentlemen. You're just not hearing about it. But we do know that President Trump has pulled us out of the World Health Organization. He has cut the U.S. ties with the group. The world has long benefited from a strong collaborative engagement with the government and the people of the United States. This is from the director of the WHO. And he said that during a press conference. He says the U.S. government and its people's contribution and generosity over many decades have been immense. Sounds like he's kind of doing a little bit of what should I say, Dave?
Dog and pony.
A little dog and pony. Oh. Please come back. He also added it's WHO's wish for his collaborations to continue. And Friday, President Trump had said the WHO failed, WHO failed, to make the requested greatly needed reform, and that the U.S. will be today terminating the relationship. Last month, President Trump had threatened in a letter that if the WHO does not commit to major substantive improvements within the next 30 days, he would make his temporary freeze of the funding permanent. And again, we're really not sure what those improvements were. I don't think they were widely discussed. It's unclear exactly what mechanism President Trump intends to use to terminate the WHO funding, because, you know, much of which is appropriated by Congress. The president typically does not have the authority to unilaterally redirect congressional funding, Dave.
Yeah. I mean, we know the president's repeatedly criticized the WHO's response to the coronavirus, which has hit the U.S. worse than any other country, and of course, coming amid scrutiny of his own administration's response to the pandemic. Trump has claimed the WHO is China-centric and blames the agency for advising against China travel bans early in the outbreak. The WHO's defended its initial response, saying it gave world leaders enough time to intervene early in the outbreak. The agency declared COVID-19 a global health emergency on January 30th, when it says there were only 82 cases outside of China and zero deaths. Meaning, according to the director general, the world had enough time to intervene. Who also defended China, saying as far back as February that the country's response to the virus was an improvement from past outbreaks like SARS. Well, in any event, March 11th, the WHO declared the outbreak a pandemic. That's when there were 121,000 global cases. We now know that there are over 6.1 million people worldwide infected. over 372,000 deaths, that according to Johns Hopkins University. So I'm sure this isn't the last we've heard of it. Certainly I suspect it'll set up just another issue for this fall's election, with shots coming back and forth between both sides of the aisle in Congress, and of course from both of the presidential candidates.
If
Hold
we have
on to your saddle, Melody.
If we have an election.
Oh gosh.
And I don't know, it's kind of looking that way. I mean, what I hate to say, what else can go wrong? But and you know, I'm not making light of what is going on, but I'm just saying it's you know, things are, once that snowball starts going down that hill, you know, it just gathers other things. And I mean, it's going to be a tough year. You know, and no one, I mean, the only news, you know, of course it was newsworthy, but no one's really talking about anything else. And and here's something that's going to impact folks who work out of their home. Maybe you didn't before the virus, COVID-19, but now maybe you do. And if you work out of your kitchen or your beach house or your permanent, or you know, your office in your home, it's probably time to think about what it might mean for your taxes. Social distancing orders in light of the pandemic has forced companies to send workers home and have them work remotely. And this trend is expected to continue. And that also tells me, Dave, that means offices will be closing. People are working from their homes. You don't get the same benefits usually. You know, offices will be closing, so maybe a little more commercial empty real estate being seen. 3 out of 4 CFOs are considering moving at least 5% of their on-site workforce to remote positions permanently after the pandemic. 5% doesn't seem like a lot, but it can. It could be very impactful. Depending on where your remote office will be based, there could be additional tax burdens in store for you and your employer. There could be even greater complexity for individuals who might reside in one state but flee to another out of state location to work remotely. There are some states where as soon as you start working there, you'll owe money. And we can finish this up when we get back. You're listening to Financial Survival. We'll be right back. Just one more time.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231. And the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And let's just finish up this, Dave, on the working remotely. I mean, you do have to pay attention, or you're going to be stuck holding the bag. And I think if you're not working as many hours and you've had a cut back in your pay and so forth, it does make a difference. So some of those states will make you file a non-resident return and have withholding. Tax presence, or nexus, as it's known in accounting circles, is at the heart of determining how states levy companies and workers. For companies, there are three factors that determine nexus: property, payroll, and sales. So telecommuting employees, the payroll element based in a different state could give an employer presence there, she said. So again, this could subject the company to state payroll tax registration requirements, corporate income tax obligations. I mean, it could really be messy.
Indeed,
and complicated.
It could. For employees, that could mean they're subject to tax withholding in the state where they're working remotely, as well as potential non-resident income tax return filings. That'll depend on the state they're in and whether they meet thresholds based on income earned or time spent there. Generally, you pay taxes based on where you work or earn income. Now, some states have pacts with other jurisdictions in the area to minimize duplicative taxes and non-resident returns for cross-border workers. One example is New Jersey and Pennsylvania have a reciprocity agreement regarding personal income taxes. Generally means Garden State residents who work in Pennsylvania won't face the Keystone State's income taxes, and vice versa. Similar agreements are in place among other mid-Atlantic states and a few states in the Midwest. Now, other states may grant an income tax credit to residents who work elsewhere. Maybe you worked in New York, but now you work from home in Connecticut for, say, 5 months. Well, Connecticut will provide you with a credit for taxes paid to New York, but the credit is limited to what Connecticut taxes you on income. If you're planning to work remotely on a longer-term basis, understand how the state you're working from will treat the income. Talk about unintended consequences, Melody. Mm. If you wind up heading to a different state altogether to wait out the pandemic, find out how long you can be there before you're subject to tax reporting requirements.
Okay, and I guess, did they ever change the date for July 15th? Is it still July 15th?
Still July 15th. There's legislation in the fourth coronavirus stimulus bill, or in A, Simi's bill passed or under consideration in the House that would send it back further to September 15th, but I believe that's the one that Mitch McConnell says he will not bring up for a vote in the Senate, that working on a separate one that he wants to move forward. Hopefully, I think a lot of people would hope that you know, there's a further couple of months to file, just particularly for those who owe. Although, again, as we reported a couple of weeks ago, when we talked about this moving back to September 15th, that's a double-edged sword, particularly for people who pay quarterly. So we'll keep you abreast, ladies and gentlemen.
You don't hear much of the news about Puerto Rico. But the Supreme Court today ruled unanimously that appointments to Puerto Rico's Financial Oversight Board were lawful. Specifically, it found that the board's member exercised primarily local powers and therefore do not require confirmation by the Senate under the Constitution. Now, this case was brought by a hedge fund that was run by Mark Brodsky and a local Puerto Rico labor union. Why does that name Mark Brodsky sound familiar?
He must be notorious.
He must be. They argued that the Puerto Rico's oversight board was improperly constituted and threatened to disrupt more than $100 billion in debt restructuring proceedings that the panel had carried out since it was established back in 2016. Now, Congress created the Financial Oversight and Management Board to address the fiscal crisis on the island. Remember the hurricanes Maria and Irma. It destroyed much of Puerto Rico's infrastructure. An owner of Puerto Rico's debt, Aurelius, did I say that right? Aurelius?
I think so.
Investment, owner of the Puerto Rico's debt, and UTIER, the workers' union, alleged that appointments to the seven-member board were unconstitutional by Obama. They argued that the members of the board are federal officials who must be confirmed by the Senate under the Constitution's Appointments Clause.
The Oversight Board, backed by the Trump administration's Department of Justice, countered that these board members are local officers and therefore do not require Senate confirmation. Justice Stephen Breyer, who authored the opinion of the court, wrote that some of the board's actions, of course, may have nationwide consequences, but he added the same can be said of many actions taken by governors or other local officials. Taking actions with nationwide consequences does not automatically transform a local official into an officer of the United States. Breyer went on to say the law that that established the Oversight Board gave it a structure, a set of duties, and related powers, all of which are consistent with making the board a part of the local Puerto Rican government. In short, the board possesses considerable power, Breyer wrote. That includes the authority to substitute its own judgment for the considered judgment of the governor and other elected officials. But this power primarily concerns local matters. Interesting implications, since apparently infrastructure in Puerto Rico is still a mess. The authorities that are responsible for funding and overseeing its operations apparently still trying to rebuild. So, perhaps now that this jurisdictional issue is settled, they can move on and hopefully get things done there to rebuild.
You know, Saturday, between going back and forth on the news on the riots, that the SpaceX mission was successful. It was interesting to watch. It was quick. But I was surprised that it seemed like they had a delay on the takeoff. Maybe that was just from where I was watching, but it seemed like there was.
No, there was some kind of glitch.
Yeah.
Same with us, too. We were in countdown mode, and all of a sudden, no, wait, it's in the air.
It's in the air.
There's still a 10.
And 9. They didn't, yeah, and it wasn't, you didn't see it take off. You didn't see it leave the base. And so I thought it was really weird. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord.
Yeah, that had to be some communications thing.
They do like the, how many times did they say, oh, I don't know what the exact words were. We're ready. We're ready. Well, not in those words, but we're ready. And before they got to the countdown. But anyway, it was fun to watch. And NASA astronaut Bob Benigan said, it's been a real honor to be just a small part of this 9-year endeavor since the last time the United States has docked with the International Space Station. So I guess they docked yesterday with the International Space Station. Dave, it only took, what, 12 or 14 hours to get there?
I thought it was 19 hours, but...
Was it 19?
I thought it was closer to 19, but still an impressive rendezvous.
My thought was it took less time to get to the space station than it does to get to Australia from flying here to Australia.
They were flying, what, at one time 5,600 miles per hour?
Wow.
Mach 2 speed. I mean, that was just on the takeoff, I think, on the blastoff. What I found particularly appealing as a viewer was getting the bird's eye view, the inside look of the astronaut in their small cabin. An impressive, three screen display. Again, their svelte spacesuits. It was an interesting, certainly a dramatic change from what we've been used to in the past. And just mere observations, regardless of one's feelings about the efficacy of space travel.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was interesting. I was listening to commentary about the screens where there's no gadgets, there's no switches, there's no... and when you look back at the other spaceships, I mean the whole front and the sides and were nothing but gadgets, and how they were talking about it should probably be safer.
Didn't mean to push that button.
Oops. But with the computers, it's supposed to be safer because the less gadgets, less something can go wrong. But unless your satellite sending those images. I don't know, but it was kind of fascinating to listen to the commentary about it. So
we'll see them again in maybe, what, 4 months, is it? Splash down in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember as a little girl watching those spaceships land in the ocean,
Oh, that really did really stimulate our imagination.
Really?
And just, hearing Walter Cronkite say as the capsule would move out of communication range as they were coming back into orbit, and, the drama of, how could it not, explode in the fire as fast as it was coming down, and then those parachutes opening and plop and right into the water. Pretty cool stuff indeed.
Let's see, we got about 3 minutes left of the program. Again, more and more folks are talking about heading to gold for a safe haven. There's another one that's saying that the U.S. is heading into an economic depression, and it's going to motivate more investors to move into their precious metals, to protect their wealth. Steven Angelo, he's founder of the SRS Rocket Report, said we could experience a U.S. economic depression and at the same time a bull market in gold and silver. Absolutely. It would be any other difference than from any recession, depression. There will be a bull market in gold and silver. But it's not that depression, recession that creates the bull market in gold and silver. It's your fiat currency that's creating the bull market in gold and silver. The creation of additional inflation and everything else that goes along with the fiat dollar that created the depression / recession. So, yes, the real motivator in the bull market is the fiat dollar. It's been observed over the past 2 months that the major U.S. stock index is headed higher, even as the economic indicators continue to show a blinking red light. He goes on and talks about how. He says, we can thank the Fed for single-handedly propping up the entire U.S. stock market and the important level on the Dow Jones that couldn't be breached. And that was the critical 18,000 support level. So when the Dow Jones Index, by miracle, bounced off this level back in March, no one should have been surprised. He explains that the forecast for the Industrial Production Index will continue to fall to a low of 77 in August from a high of 109 before the global pandemic. The Industrial Production Index fell parallel with the Dow Jones Index during the 08 and 09 financial and economic crisis.
He also points to the massive increase in liquid money supply. That's something we've been looking at recently. That surged nearly $3.5 trillion, actually over that figure in just the past 2.5 months. The present rate of increase of that money supply was more than double the $1.5 trillion increase from January 08 to June of 09. Now, San Angelo believes the huge increase in liquid money supply will be very inflationary, and that will be certainly positive for gold and other precious metals. And this is likely only the beginning in what will be sort of an upward circulating cycle. He believes the second half of 2020 will bring a lot larger problems for the U.S. and global markets, especially when the current negative economic indicators snowball. And he says, as a result, the Fed and other central banks around the world will have to print even more money.
Wow. And we're out of time, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us today. I'll be here tomorrow with Butch. Dave will be here with me Wednesday along with Wendy Wilson. So I'm Melody Cedarstrom. Thanks for listening. Be safe and God bless.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye.